eat any herds. My mind briefly flashed back to the little experiment that I just saw with the ninja clan, and I once again turned to look at Aurevi. The little goddess looked at me curiously, noticing my gaze on her. "Yes, bro? How's your dungeon doing? Those slimes probably died a long time ago, right?" A thought had occurred to me when I remembered those slimes. Aurevi suddenly grinned broadly at my question. "With the dungeon expanding slowly, they were able to get quite a lot of insects and stuff to eat. Although the original two died, it wasn't before they left descendants. Right now, there are already over 100 slimes in Danny."
"Danny?"
"Yep, Danny the Dungeon. It's the name I gave him. Though, with how many slimes there are, they've pretty much become the only monster in the dungeon. And will even eat anything else that tries to enter," she explained proudly. "Did they ever show any signs of having ki? The blood of a monster capable of using ki was the key component to chakra storage. So if those slimes could produce ki by now..."
"Yep," she declared again. "About 3 generations after you dropped them off, I noticed their acidic properties had gotten stronger. Worried that it might have been a mutation, I did a bit of checking, but found that it was because they had ki flowing through their bodies. It was enhancing their slime coating and thus their acid. That's how they've been able to eat other creatures that wander into the dungeon."
"Note to self, do not underestimate ki slimes." "Got it. Okay, I might need to take 1 or 2 of them for testing myself eventually. If I could get rid of the acid, then those slimes would make the perfect ink for chakra talismans and things like that in the future. There might even be other uses for them." Aurevi nodded happily at my request, and I turned back to once again look at the screen. Since things were going a bit too slow still, I increased the speed further. Now it was only a few more minutes until they reached the edge of the forest, and I reduced it to the normal accelerated rate. Within Shara's forest, as the halflings came to call it, sat the first true halfling city of Sharak. Although Savor had been a kingdom, but it had still been built mostly in the style of a rest. With Sharak, they made it bigger, safer, and able to hold vastly more people. But even so, an unusually large crowd was beginning to gather within the dirt paths of the city. Earlier in the day, the scouts reported a large group of halflings had entered the forest from the enemy territory. Deciding to give them a name, the halflings called them the Charun, named after a vaguely similar creature to the north. The Charun was a large-scaled lizard that ran around on 4 legs but had the upper body of a scaler. Take away the scales and replace the lower body with that of a horse, and the Charun strongly resembled the Charun. Hayback, the village chief, was the first to greet the scouts as they entered the village.
"Welcome, welcome. It has been many seasons since we last laid eyes on you."
He spoke warmly to the probing fingers. In all truth, some had even thought that these scouts had long since perished within the Charun territory. Hayback himself had been concerned and often wondered if that had been the case.
"Many thanks, brother," the appointed leader of the probing fingers, Jalvak, answered. "It was a long journey, but we kept our wits about us."
From the appearance of the scouts, there were almost no injuries, and those that were injured had only been so by monsters. Hayback nodded his head repeatedly.
"Yes, very good. Tell me, how was your mission?"
When the village chief asked this, everyone in the vicinity stopped what they were doing to listen. There was a mix of opinions on the next step of this plan, but the vast majority of the halflings had still not forgiven the Charun for the events that led to Shara's forest receiving its name. Jalvak smiled in response.
"We have scouted a large amount of the Charun territory. In it, we managed to find a total of 3 cities. However, there did not seem to be signs of further settlement south, so we returned. Apart from the cities, there are only the wandering herds."
The smile on Hayback's face grew 3 sizes that moment, obviously pleased with the report.
"Very good indeed. I'll send word to the other cities and rests. Now that you have returned, we can begin our plans for the next step."
After saying that, he ordered one of the nearby halflings to bring him something to write with. Meanwhile, Jalvak glanced around the surrounding wooden buildings, taking in the scenery.
"This place has changed so much since we left," he said under his breath, catching Hayback's attention, who only smiled slightly.
"No, my friend, I think you have just been away too long," he joked, shaking his head.
"Now, let us spread news of your return."
"Yep, they're still going through with it," I said with a sigh, having not really expected anything else. I at least had an idea for what to do once the situation became grave for the centaurs. However, if I acted too early, then it would have some rather bad results. As such, I could only wait, knowing that the wandering herds would be easy pickings for the organized halflings. Seeming to understand my thoughts, Aurevi spoke up from the bed behind me.
"I tried getting Trival to move the herds into cities, but most of them didn't listen when his priests spread the message. According to him, they are the ones who are still set in the old ways, and saw that message as an attempt for the variants to control them."
"Okay, so the ones in the cities are the ones we actually like. Though there are probably also those herds that just haven't happened upon one of the cities to hear that message as well. Well, either way, this war isn't going to last much longer. I was thankful to that, at least. The centaurs likely considered the war over 25 years ago, when there was no further signs of activity from the halflings. Little did they know, they provoked some fierce midgets that knew how to hold a grudge.
Chapter 6 It was roughly a month after the return of the halfling scouts that the leaders of the various cities had all convened in the city of Shirak. The various representatives had all agreed to use this as the staging point for the upcoming war, as it was the closest city to the southern edge of the forest. Although I didn't pay too much attention towards the contents of the meeting, I knew I wouldn't have to wait very long. After all, from the viewpoint of the accelerated time, the entire meeting took less than a second, and within minutes the various representatives had all gone back to their own respective cities. From there I watched as a swarm of halflings began to converge in the center of the forest. Each halfling scout was accompanied by a group of 50 battle hands, the name that they had given their soldiers. The battle hands themselves could be warriors, monster tamers, archers, rogues, any combat class. But with over 300 scouts, that meant that there was over 15,000 battle hands in all. Even looking at the force that the centaurs invaded the forest with, I could only see this as stronger, especially since almost every halfling had with them some form of monster or animal companion, further bolstering their numbers. I half expected them to pour out of the forest like a tide, wiping out everything in their path. However, that is strangely not what happened. Instead, they scattered, with each unit leaving the forest at different points guided by their scouts. In this manner, they were entirely undetected by the centaurs, as they did not allow themselves to be spotted. And perhaps they knew that they were unable to take out the cities. Or maybe they just wanted to target the easier prey first. Either way, not a single unit moved towards the cities, instead carving a wide path around them, ensuring that they never so much as saw a city on the horizon. However, doing that also got them to their targets much faster, because the wandering herds also tended to take paths that led them far away from the cities. If they wanted to be close to them, they would simply join the cities themselves, after all. Thus, the first battle was only 2 days after the first group of halflings left the forest. I could see as the halflings stealthily hunted the first herd they came across, waiting until it was deep in the night before they attacked. Even then, they did not get away without losses, despite the herd not being too large. One of their assassins did not kill the person keeping watch in a single strike, and it resulted in the rest of the herd waking up. Ultimately, 2 halflings had died in the ambush, and the group immediately returned to the forest. However, by that time, 5 other groups had already left, scouring the plains to search for their own targets. Little by little, more of the wandering herds fell in silence, taken out by the halflings. However, at the same time, the halfling units only stayed in the plains until they had someone suffer a serious injury, or death. As soon as that happened, they returned to the forest like the first group.
While they wished to kill the centaurs, they were not seeking to simply throw their lives away. Still, no matter how one looks at it, the halflings were simply killing too many centaurs to go unnoticed. With them not knowing how to hide the bodies, it quickly led to other herds finding the remains of the battles. Those that did made their way to the nearest city to beg for shelter, warning them of the impending threats. Like this, the news that the war had not truly ended had once again spread throughout the plains. Halloran Earthshaker stood atop the Round Court. As the king of the centaurs, naturally there was information he was able to see that nobody else could, and this very knowledge made him question himself for the first time in his reign. Back when the previous battle occurred, and he had sent his armies to wipe out the forest folk, the system had acknowledged it. First, at the start of the battle, it told him that he had officially declared war on an unknown kingdom. However, mere hours later, he also received news that he had won that war. There were several things that he could learn from this. First of all, there was no such thing as a secret war. He had no idea when the fighting was about to begin, yet received the report immediately. He could only assume that the enemy king had also received that information. Thus, he assumed that any hostile attack from an army on a different kingdom would have the world declare a war. Then why was he receiving no such message now? It was clear that his people were being slaughtered. More and more centaurs ran to the cities, seeking shelter from the forest folk. They spoke of mangled corpses, and some even found the limbs of the smaller race at the site to prove that it was them. So why was he not receiving the declaration of war? Was it possible that this group was not associated with the kingdom? If that was the case, then how could they assemble an army able to wipe out so many so quickly? Still, whether or not this was an official war, there were steps that needed to be taken. The plains were no longer safe to roam. Thus, Halloran spoke from atop the court, his keys spreading his voice far across the city. While he was not a variant, he was still one of the most powerful monks known to the centaurs. "Heed my words. Assemble the defenses. Archers, mages, and druids, man the walls. Shamans, conduct regular scrying. I want 10 Pegasus variants to deliver message to the other cities. We must protect our people. Protect our cities and do not allow the forest folk to enter. Grant shelter to any of Trival's children and keep a watchful eye. I fear that this is far from over." I couldn't help but chuckle as I noticed the king atop his castle. I observed his thoughts and saw his worries. From what I could tell, there was actually a very simple reason why the system didn't notify him of any war. Not a single one of his citizens had been killed yet. While he may consider himself the king of all centaurs, and many others do as well, it is not really the case. Using the map, I could clearly see that his kingdom only covered the three cities. The wandering centaurs were doing so mainly because they did not accept his rule, and were thus not included in his kingdom. So really it was only natural that there was no war declaration yet. Though this did show something interesting. "Terra," I called back to her, rousing the cat girl goddess from her state of half-slumber. "Is it possible to do a covert war?" I asked curiously, rather keen on finding that out. There have been many wars in history that were conducted without the knowledge of the general public. Sometimes even without the knowledge of the leading powers themselves. All it took was one influential person.
"Kinda," she said with a yawn. "If the leader of a kingdom orders any directly hostile action on another kingdom, then the war will be declared when those orders are carried out. However, if, say, a general of the army sent his troops to attack of his own initiative, then it would not be a war. Likewise, if other people of influence gave the orders without the king's knowledge, then there would be no declaration, though I imagine that any ruler who found their people trying to incite war without their approval would not take kindly to that knowledge once it was discovered." I paused for a moment to consider that. It left quite a lot open to be misused, but at the same time this was a system designed by another keeper. I didn't expect it to be completely perfect. As such, I could only nod my head. Once I looked back to the computer, I decided to take a look at some of the other races. I hadn't been able to pay as much attention to them lately as I would have liked, due to this war. However, now that things were pretty much decided, I could spare a few minutes to check up on them. The first target of my observation was the dwarves. To my surprise, they had actually spread out to cover a considerable distance. The original 7 cities had now become nearly 100, though most of them were positioned either near mountains or ore veins. Judging by their positioning, I had to assume that they used a shaman to find an ore vein, though I was still not entirely clear on how shaman magic worked. All I knew for certain was that they were not a combat or crafting class. Rather, like scouts, they focused on getting information. The only difference was that they gained their information from nature itself. Either way, closer observation showed me that the nearly 100 cities of the dwarves had all become 3 kingdoms. The first was the Iron Dwarf Kingdom, the ones who lived near the mountains and devoted themselves to the forge. Their king was currently the highest-level blacksmith in the entire world. The next was the Hill Dwarf Kingdom. As the name suggests, these dwarves made their home among various tall hills, using the height advantage to keep watch for monster threats. Among the 3 kingdoms, they were the most combat-oriented, with many of their soldiers armed with metal hammers or maces. Well, I call them hammers and maces, but they are basically just misshapen lumps of metal on a metal stick. The 3rd kingdom was called Finra, and I honestly wasn't sure what to make of that. To be fair to them, they were quite a distance away from either of the other 2 kingdoms, and only had a 12 cities under their rule. As for their specialty, they didn't really seem to have one. They were weaker than the Iron Dwarf Kingdom in the Forge, and weaker than the Hill Dwarf Kingdom in battle. If anything, I could praise their culture. So far, they were the only dwarf kingdom that had actually built facilities for public entertainment. Shaking my head, I went to look at the next race, one I was actually rather interested in checking up on. The humans had expanded almost half as much as the halflings, which was already quite an achievement. They had various cities spread out throughout their explored territory, numbering almost 300. However, unlike the dwarves, there were far too many human kingdoms to take the time to explore the specialties of each one. At least I couldn't take the time to do so without pausing the world, or else the war might be over when I was done. However, I could tell that there were nearly 30 kingdoms, with each one controlling an average of 10 cities. This number went up and down depending on the kingdom, but it mostly stayed the same. One thing that I was surprised to see was that there was really only one war going on between any of these kingdoms. I had expected almost every kingdom to be in some kind of war, but after taking a look at the kingdoms involved, I began to understand why. The 2 warring kingdoms of the humans were known as Hanbei and Krilla. While Krilla seemed to be a very ordinary human kingdom, though one highly focused on its fighting force, Hanbei was a different matter. Hanbei did not have many archers, mages, or druids, but what it did have was monks. From what I could tell, over half of Hanbei's population had gained access to ki. Not only that, but many of them had gained another class, one almost exclusive to their kingdom. The martial artist class, something that did not even exist yet the last time I had descended. And naturally, the highest level martial artist was their queen, one who had the same name as the kingdom itself. Okay. I reached over and grabbed the piece of paper, writing a message to Behenna. Did you just rearrange the letters of your name when you made your incarnation? When I looked at the name of the kingdom and its queen, I couldn't help but immediately assume that it was Behenna, especially since she should be the best martial artist among the humans. A reply quickly came back to me through the paper. It's not like that. I didn't get to choose the name. They picked it for me. I could tell by the handwriting that she was giving a rushed response. That or she really needs to practice her handwriting. Apparently, Hanbei is supposed to be a lucky name to them, so my mortal parents called me that. And your kingdom? I felt my lips tugging up into a smile as I wrote that down, planning to tease her a bit. Okay, that one is also really not my fault. The last king tried to push himself on me when he saw how strong I was. After I took care of that old man, everyone just made me queen. They even changed the kingdom's name. That's fucked up, right? Uh-huh, I wrote, nodding my head silently. So why is the goddess of peace currently waging a war in the mortal world? This was the main part I was curious about. The rest of it was just me wanting to tease her.
You found out about that, huh?
That response came rather quickly, before more words began to appear below it. First, I'd like to say that they attacked first. They wanted to enslave my people to learn how we got so strong. That's why that war was declared, but I'm keeping on the defensive. From what I can tell, the other kingdoms seem to be pretty interested in it, too, and are just waiting to see what happens.
Just what happens when I'm not looking, I thought to myself incredulously.
Apparently, Behenna had managed to not only become a queen, but gathered the attention of the other kingdoms on her and made herself a target. I thought you were planning to spread your martial arts teachings through your priests. I couldn't help but ask that after giving it some thought.
I tried. Most of them couldn't understand my explanations.
Right now, once I finish this war, I'm planning to send envoys from the kingdom to spread the teachings. I think that they will accept and understand it if I use both the priests and the envoys.
She's totally going to go down in human history as a demigod of Behenna, or something.
I shook my head with a sigh. Thinking about it, Tubrak might even be an official of the Iron Dwarf Kingdom. The only reason that I didn't think he was king was because the current king looked way too old to be him.
Well, let me know if you need any help. I wrote a final message to Behenna before turning my attention away from the humans.
Next up on my world tour was the elves. Though, for this, I really didn't expect there to be any progress at all from Rian. Her incarnation should still just be a kid, after all. What I found was pretty much the same as the last time I looked. Although they had added a few more cities, the elves had done very little in the way of exploring their territory. They appeared to be even less nomadic than the dwarves, which made me briefly consider that there may never be the appearance of things like wood elves or dark elves in this world. Still, the specialty of the elves had remained magic, and they had the strongest of almost every class dealing with either mana or natural energy. Although they did not have the same understanding of those energies as the ninja cult... village? The ninja village? Anyways, though, their knowledge about the nature of the energies was a bit lacking. Their research into the various symbols that make up spells had gone far ahead. The elves, like the centaurs and halflings, only had one kingdom, the same one that had existed since the dawn of their civilization. Although the royal family of Gandor had been replaced at some point, they had never lost the name, nor their focus. There were wide buildings devoted to the practice and study of magic, and within those I could see a few higher class spells being used. Although I did not know the spells themselves, their quality was easy to recognize by the fact that the spell formations appeared in the air around them. According to Rian, that was a unique phenomenon that only happened when an element of a spell passed a certain quality. And going by the variety of spells being shown, they had discovered a few new patterns that I need to talk to Rian about next time I see her. Finally, I turned my attention towards the Beastkin. Their change was perhaps the most drastic since my last look at their civilization. They had over 500 cities, with a total of 4 kingdoms. However, these kingdoms did not seem to have any sort of aggression towards each other, and would freely trade between them. To my surprise, the kingdoms were not separated by race, but by distance. Each kingdom spanned a wide distance before another kingdom appeared. However, there was something strange about this. Each kingdom had an identical structure for government. All 4 of them were theocracies, worshipping the faith of the sister goddesses, or simply the sister's faith. The temples for this religion appeared in almost every beastkin city. From what I could tell, every kingdom's ruler was chosen by this religion as well. This made me wonder something.
Okay, Terra, question time again.
She once again asked in a groggy voice. Looking back, I saw that Auravi seemed to have dozed off in Terra's arms, though I wasn't sure if she was just pretending this time. How come all of the Beastkin kingdoms follow your religion, and the religion basically controls everything? Wouldn't that really make it just one kingdom, not 4? I asked, my brows knit together.
Ah, they decided to do it like that. She spoke with a tired smile.
The kingdoms were starting to get too big for one ruler to manage it, so they came up with that idea. So they split it into 4. Terraria, Eudonia, Akal, and Kilios. Each country worships all four of us, but focuses specifically on one of the goddesses for its main teachings. I nodded my head slightly as I heard that, easily able to guess which country worshipped which goddess. Do you have something like a pope to oversee the four kingdoms? When I asked that, Terra shook her head. They haven't really thought of anything like that, or asked us for any help in structuring their organization. Right now, the four queens are treated as equal representatives of us four goddesses, and so far that has led to a friendly relation between the countries. I see. And the reason why Terraria is the closest one to the ninja village's forest? I asked, a wry smile on my face. I don't want them getting found too fast. It would ruin the whole secret village thing. Give them a few more generations, and they'll be old enough to take care of themselves. She finished with a slow, confident nod, before closing her eyes again. Well, I could understand her reasoning for that. Anyways, the four kingdoms really did have their specialties, though they seemed to be connected in pairs. Akal and Kilios were the fighters and the hunters, defending their own kingdom and their neighbors from monsters. They worked to train their bodies to the limits. And like with Henbai, martial arts had begun to appear among the two kingdoms, though they were mostly limited to the Ursa for now. For Terraria and Eudonia, they focused more on culture and entertainment, while each also held a specialty of their own. Terraria had the most shamans, and Eudonia had the most alchemists. Eudonia also had the only three clerics that currently existed in the world. Throughout these two kingdoms, there were many small theaters built to entertain the masses with regular performances. Altogether, the four kingdoms of the Beastkin held a special kind of balance where each supported the others. Honestly, if they really did come up with all that on their own, I was impressed. Now, we return to our regularly scheduled viewing of midgets and horsemen killing each other.
Chapter 7 Atop the city walls of Sorrow's Shield, a line of centaurs stood watching the plains. They could see the many short figures on the distant horizon, with numbers uncountable. They were like a plague that had washed over their fields, the Cathar, or night killers, as the centaurs called them. Out of any beast or monster seen to date, they were the most fierce. Few people truly knew at this point how the fighting began. All they knew was that the Cathar had been hunting their people for months, wiping out any herd that dared wander beyond the walls of safety. Even the flying Pegasus variants were sometimes brought down from the skies when they attempted to convey messages to the other cities. Sadly, none of the knights of the Round Stable had been stationed at Sorrow's Shield, as they were always kept in the capital of King's Hope unless dispatched. And by this point, it was far too late to expect them to be dispatched. The guards along the walls had the feeling that merely the Cathar that they could see in the horizon numbered more than the entire population of Sorrow's Shield. Yet still, they did not despair. Although they may have hid within their stone walls, they had hope. And that hope was precisely those guards. The tales of the Cathar and the Battle of First Blood, as the centaurs had come to call it, told many things about the abilities of the Cathar. They possessed great stealth and strategy, and the ability to control the creatures of the wild. Yet the stories spoke very little of any magical use. Using this information, the guards of Sorrow's Shield formed a special defense, a defense of unicorns, stationed regularly along the walls. As the first Knights of the Round had done in the Battle of King's Hope so many years ago, they fought numbers with strength. They took the high ground and launched their spells and arrows at any who dared to approach. Like this, the Cathar had not dared to approach the city walls, for every time they did, fire and ice rained mercilessly upon them. But at the same time, the centaurs were unable to leave the safety of their cities. The Cathar were able to camp safely beyond the range of the spells, making their presence known along the horizon, a clear warning to any who would approach. Unknown to them, a similar situation had arisen around both Trival's Hold and King's Hope, though the latter had a slightly better result.
With the presence of the king and his knights, they were able to extend the range of safety by a good degree, forcing the Cathar to recognize their power and make their camps further away. However, even the knights of the Round Table dared not leave their walls.
"Well, that went about as well as I had expected," I said with a sigh, shaking my head as I finished fast-forwarding through the lesser skirmishes of the war between the halflings and the centaurs. By now, the forest had been almost emptied of halflings, leaving only a few behind to manage the rests. As for every else, they had begun to construct new cities just outside of the centaur towns. They called these cities battle holds, for obvious reasons. Each one was hastily constructed, and had to be remade whenever the weather turned fierce. Yet it housed a population of halflings that could easily wipe out any centaurs that left their cities. But at the same time, they were unable to attack, for two reasons. First, they had no method to scale the large stone walls around the cities. But more importantly, the centaurs carried a major advantage over the halflings whenever they brought out the unicorn variants. Although the halflings had no innate properties that made magic hard to learn, the way that they established their society led to that result. After all, magic is grown through shared knowledge and research, but they spend so much time apart that they do not have the luxury to share such information. Even those that do end up getting the mage class don't take it very far, often favoring the classes relating to exploration or monsters. This led to a stalemate that could last forever, or until the centaurs starved within their cities. Although they had learned how to tend fields, that would only last for so long without the proper techniques, techniques that they have simply not had the time to discover, which meant that now was the time to move. "Terra," I called out to her, looking back to find her still laying groggily on the bed. "Which city is your incarnation near?" It took her a moment to open her eyes and register my question.
"I was taken to Tribal's Hold," she answered with a yawn. At some point it seemed that Auravi had squirmed her way out of Terra's arms to be replaced by an actual body pillow. I nodded my head, writing a message to Rian. I sent her the information about the reputation system and let her know that I intended to buy it. There was currently a rather pressing need for it, so I didn't wait for her approval. I knew that she would ultimately agree to me buying the system, as it would be a great help in the long run as well. After buying the easy reputation system, I was left with exactly 607 points, though I was sure that number would increase if I checked my notifications to receive any royalties or rewards. Instead, I hit the great pause button of the world, turning back to Terra. With the world paused, it seemed as if someone had suddenly splashed water all over her. She was instantly awakened, looking at me with bright eyes. "Are you getting ready to intervene?" she asked, hopefully, and I nodded my head. "Okay. Since you paused the world, I take it you want my help with something?" "Yeah," I nodded again. "I want you to look over my idea for a backstory to use when I descend this time." As I said that, I created a pencil and a paper and began writing. Though what do I really write? Okay. First, is there a way to check the history of people? I know you've mentioned having the world's histories archived in your memory and being able to review what has happened after the fact. Terra nodded her head with a smile. "It's actually pretty easy once you get the hang of it," she explained. "Just focus on someone like you would when you want to read their thoughts or check their aura. Then imagine a little clock over their head and rewind it. You'll be able to see the situation surrounding that person for the time period you view. Oh, and you can use it on locations, too, if you want." "Well, that definitely makes this easier." After thanking her for that information, I went through the important people in Tribal's Hold, reviewing their past for important details that I could use to seamlessly appear. Thankfully, the faking my death part is really easy for me. All I have to do is use the world host, and there will be no question that I actually died. After I spent a few hours reviewing personal histories, I began writing out the details of what I wanted for the reputation. To summarize, I was the elder brother of the city's guard captain, a unicorn who had specialized in magical research. Although I spent most of my time alone in order to create less issues with the new system, I never acted without confidence. This eventually led the guard captain to have a great deal of trust in me. Once I was done writing the entire story down, I had Terra review it. She glanced at it a few times before nodding her head. "You won't be able to use any of your powers besides the mage class if you do it like this, you know," she asked, looking at me. "I know," I replied, with a smile. "I'm not going to be working alone. I'll get others to help on my end." "On your end?" I had chosen Trival's Hold because it was the city where Terra was stationed. "This is a difficult request, but I need to create as much fear as possible in the halflings. I'm going to lead the centaurs out of the city and slaughter the halflings stationed there. I need you to make sure you are among the ones that get away. Once I'm done, I'll need you to spin the story and try to warn the others outside King's Hope, and finally Sorrow's Shield." Taking a deep breath, I shook my head regretfully. I did not like the idea of what I was about to do, and I'm sure I would like doing it even less. "We're going to turn the situation around and put the halflings back in the forest." Terra looked at me doubtfully before raising a question. "Won't that just lead back to this situation all over again? This won't end the war, you know." "I know. This is only the first step." I smiled slightly. "This is just to make sure that they see each other on equal footing, rather than as monsters or beasts. After that, we're going to start opening up a dialogue between them. Let them gradually come to understand each other's languages." Terra made a soft sound of understanding, seeming to follow my thoughts. "Okay, that can work. It won't lead to extinction for either race, at least. Even though they won't really be friends for a very long time, it is a good start." Thankfully, we had the perfect system already in place that would allow languages to be learned easily with enough time and effort. Though that also wasn't the end of my plan yet. However, before I could move on to the final step, I would have to wait and watch how things develop after implementing this much. Now on to creating a body for myself, I thought, as I turned back towards the computer. By the time I noticed, I saw that I had a reply from Rion, giving me the approval I had expected for the new system. For this trip, I immediately purchased a world host, dropping my total by another 30. That way I could get out of the body whenever I wanted, and there would be no problems. After that I began working on the body myself, though even I considered the body to be strange this time. The main oddity of the body was its coloring. While most centaurs had a rather normal mix of colors that could almost be compared to horses of the previous Earth, unicorns were different. In almost all unicorns their fur and hair were only a single color, but that color was not limited to the normal spectrum for their breeds. There could be unicorn centaurs with bright red fur, pitch black, or even a light blue. The fur that I chose for my host this time was a vibrant pink. Why? Because this was another reason why he hid himself away in seclusion, not interacting much with even the people of his own city. At the same time, it caused others to somewhat mock him for his coloring, but at the same time, they recognized his abilities as a mage and a scholar. When I looked at the body I had created, I shivered uncomfortably. The image of a muscular male frame attached to a bright pink horse body. I hope I never have a reason to use something like this again. Even Terra was shaking in laughter on the bed, though that stopped when I unpaused the world. "No fair," she yawned, immediately tired again. "It was just getting good." Shaking my head, I fast-forwarded the world again, looking for the proper timing to introduce my character into the world. Guard Captain Karlach Hardback stood atop the walls, gazing out at the distant Cathar camps. He had been trying to come up with some way to defeat this encirclement for months, but to no avail. Anyone he had sent out would be lucky to return alive, but he knew that they could not simply sit here and wait forever. "Captain," one of his guards trotted up the stone ramp to meet him, getting his attention.
"What is it, Havoc?" he asked, glancing over to the guard.
Suddenly he felt a strange energy washing over him for the briefest of moments, but afterwards continued as if nothing had happened.
"I have a message from your brother, Dale."
The captain nodded when he heard that, a sudden hopeful look in his eyes. He said he knows a way to push back the Cathar.
Chapter 8
Karlak hastened down to his brother's stable as soon as he heard the news, pulling the leather flap open to enter.
"Is it true, Dale?" he asked hastily,
much to the surprise of the pink-haired centaur residing within.
"You have truly found an end to our plight?"
Dale seemed to hesitate for a few moments before nodding his head. "I have, but I'll need some people to help me first," he spoke, seeming a bit reluctant to actually use whatever method he had thought up. However, Karlak barely noticed that, only focusing on the fact that there was a way out.
"Of course. Tell me what you need. I'll put the guards at your disposal if you can get us out of this."
Karlak had already tried any tactic he could think of, whether it was to drop stones on the Cathar from above, or to disturb the ground beneath their feet. But everything only resulted in further loss of life. So the idea that his brother had a way to get through this was like a sign from Trival himself.
"I need as many mages and druids as you can spare," Dale spoke, seeming deep in thought.
This was originally the city of Variance, so it was only natural that there were an abundance of unicorns proficient in magic. Even if some had already been lost in the previous attempts, there was still more in reserve.
"All right, I'll go gather as many as I can," Karlak said, with a nod, turning and rushing out of the stable.
It was only a few hours later when a message arrived for Dale, saying that his volunteers had been gathered in the guard stable. When he arrived, the originally noisy room immediately quieted down. There were many who were against the idea of putting the lives of the entire city in the hands of someone sometimes seen as an outcast. However, the general consensus was that they would listen to his idea and see how it sounded. Dale looked nervously around the stable, though that was not unexpected. The guard stable was a stone structure built along the base of the wall, and was currently packed with over 100 unicorn centaurs, as well as the only Chilene born in this generation. Dale seemed slightly relieved when he saw the Chilene's presence, but soon controlled himself and began to explain his plan. In order to prepare, he had all of the mages memorize a single spell, while all of the druids would practice a particular ability of their own. Like this, they prepared for 3 full days before acting. On the 3rd day, the sky was clear, with not a cloud to be seen. According to Dale, this weather was required for his plan to work, and also why it had taken so long for him to tell everyone about it. When the gate of the wall opened, there was movement from the enemy camp. Several dozen Cathar emerged from their tents, gathering their weapons and bestial companions. It was clear that they were ready for another fight, but this time would be different. As the distance between the two parties lessened, the Cathar remained patiently in their camps. Time had proven that the centaurs posed no real threat to an army of their size, so they were in no rush to greet such a small group, and allowed them to approach. Even when the front line of the centaurs began conjuring shields to protect those around them, there was no hostile action taken, aside from the beasts and monsters to prepare for the fight. However, even when the centaurs were less than 50 lengths away from the Cathar, all they did was draw their bows and prepare to battle. It was at that point that they seemed to consider taking things seriously, but at that point it was already too late. Although most centaurs wouldn't notice it, but the Cathar, who were sensitive to their surroundings, noticed a strange shift in the wind. At the same time as the wind shifted, over 50 centaurs simultaneously fired their magic, sending orbs of fire into the Cathar camp. The target was not the Cathar themselves, but the dry grass at their feet, which slowly spread out to their surroundings. Among the Cathar, several panicked shouts were let out as they moved away from the burning patches of grass, sending their beasts and monsters to attack while their bows fired their arrows. The arrows harmlessly struck the magical barriers, while the monsters and beasts were unable to react in time before something happened, which would be remembered for generations to come. The fire did not only spread outwards, but seemed to be carried upon the wind, spiraling into the sky to form a thin column of flame. This alone might not have been too bad, but it was more than just the fire. The winds that had caught the flame also picked up many Cathar, throwing them into the growing inferno. Back with the centaurs, almost 40 druids were deep in focus, urging the tornado of fire to grow. Smoke rose into the air like a black cloud, yet this was still not the end. Several Cathar sought to charge the centaurs, ending this attack from the source. Yet every time they did, the lone Chileen would wave his arms, causing a stream of fire to separate from the tornado, striking out like a whip at the attacker. This gave the tornado the appearance of having arms of flame as it washed over the Cathar camp. At that point, the gathered Cathar realized that they had little choice but to retreat. While they could kill centaurs, there was nothing that they could do to kill wind and fire. But how could escape be so easy? The further the centaurs advanced with their menacing weapon, the larger it grew. The screams of the Cathar filled the plains. The smell of smoldering flesh carried upon the winds. Blood and bone scattered among the burning grass, while figures could be seen in agony flying within the towering inferno. It was only when there were no more Cathar to be seen did the druids finally have their respite. While the mages offered the spark to ignite the field, it was the druids who had to maintain and control the tornado. Even with so many of them, holding it for so long had drained them. Enough that, had the Cathar noticed, they could have returned and fought without fear. Tarak ran through the plains, an unusually calm expression on her childlike face. With the rest of her halfling family dead, she imagined that she should be feeling some emotional turmoil. However, none of that came, and if it did, she quickly suppressed it. She knew that these were not her true family, and she had been given a job to do, so she ran, as fast and as far as her legs would carry her. It was over a week later when Tarak arrived at the halfling camp outside of King's Hope, stopping and panting for breath. While she had appeared calm before, now her face seemed to hold unprecedented terror. "Please, I need to speak with the Elder," she shouted at the camp, her voice shaking. Parts of Tarak's clothes had been charred black, the result of being too close to the initial burn. However, she had ran away and swiftly treated her injuries, leaving naught but dirt and soot to show the ordeal she had previously been through. Still, her appearance was quite shocking to behold for the halflings gathered around. Soon a small man with wrinkled features walked out of one of the tents before moving to approach Tarak.
"What is it, child?"
he asked in a tender voice, looking at the damage done to Tarak's clothing. Although he couldn't recognize this particular halfling, it was clearly not someone from his own camp.
"The camp at the second city was destroyed," Tarak spoke in a shaking voice, pulling her arms up to hold herself. Anyone who looked would see her eyes beginning to water. Without knowing the names of the cities themselves, they had only labeled them the first, second, and third cities based on how far away from the forest they were.
"What?" the elder asked in shock, reeling back as the news hit him.
"How could that be?"
From the reports their scouts had found, the third city where they were camped was supposedly the strongest. For the second city to have wiped out the camp outside their walls, while the third city still hid inside, was unthinkable.
"It's true. The Charun emerged from their walls as they had many times before, but this time they summoned fire that rose to the sky."
Tarak began to explain in a broken voice.
"The screaming. There was nothing we could do to stop them. I don't know how many people managed to escape."
The halfling elder nodded his head, a grim expression on his face.
"Why did you come here to warn us? You could have made it back to the forest, back to safety," he asked, trying to comfort her. His tone was not one of accusation, but concern.
"I couldn't. I had to come and warn you," Tarak confessed softly, tears starting to streak down her cheeks. "I didn't want to be alone. My family was at that camp."
The elder flinched when he heard that, feeling a pain in his heart. He nodded his head faintly, his voice turning soft.
"You can rest here, child. We won't let any harm come to you.
When we return to the forest, you can come with us." Tarak nodded her head gently as she heard that, following him back to the camp.
It was in this camp where Tarak lived out her next few weeks. Every now and then people could find her gazing longingly at the sky. Most assumed that she was remembering those that she had lost in the camp, though none brought the subject up with her again after the first day. As far as they were concerned after that, she was one of their own. Even though they heard the report from Tarak, they did not pack up and leave. Rather, they began considering every appearance of the Charun to be serious, not making the same mistake as her camp did. They even doubled the night watch, ensuring that there was no chance that the Charun would be capable of approaching them in the cover of darkness. However, their worries only lasted for those 2 weeks before a group of Charun could be seen along the horizon, slowly marching towards them. Their numbers were almost as big as the entire halfling camp, each one armed with some type of weapon. When the Charun were just barely able to see the walls of the third city, ivory horns were lifted into the air and blown into, a loud sound echoing through the plains. Looking back at the city, they could almost see the confusion in the actions of the Charun. Yet at the same time, there was hope. As one group approached from the horizon, the gates of the city gradually opened. A second group approaching from the city. Not good, the elder cursed under his breath. If it was just one group of even numbers, the halflings were confident in being able to achieve victory on the open plains. But when they were outnumbered as they were, being approached from both sides, he began to feel an invisible pressure. This only increased even more when he noticed Tarak not far away, looking at the Charun that had approached from the horizon. Her face was white, her entire body shaking as she muttered under her breath, "It's them. They're here." Her words immediately alerted the elder, causing him to look out to that group. She had told him before of the pink Charun that led the charge that destroyed their camp, and now that same unmistakably pink figure was leading the very group that now approached them. This gave him no choice but to admit that things were bad. The tale of fires reaching up to the sky, of entire families burning as they tumbled through the air, he did not wish for that to happen here. And so, he gave the order to retreat. Chapter 9. I gave a slight sigh as I watched the scene unfold below. After having rescued Trival's hold, the entire city's morale was higher than ever. Using the authority of the local guard captain, I had the entire city mobilized to rescue the other two. After that, I left things on autopilot and returned to the admin room. Now I could see as the halflings charged the centaurs, blocking their escape. However, from the looks of things, they were not aiming to fight, but trying to break through to run away. Using their smaller size, they ducked between narrow legs, keeping out of reach of most weapons. Although a few unlucky halflings managed to get pinned down under hoof, spear, or arrow, the majority still managed to break through. After that, they disregarded everything and began running at full sprint. Still, I had no doubt that the centaurs could catch up with them if they chose to do so, being more suitably built for long-distance running. However, my host stopped them from doing so, choosing to first meet up with the king and knights of King's Hope. Fast-forwarding, I watched as he summarized the events that had happened in the other city, and was praised by several of the knights for getting them out of this situation. This part of the events I wasn't particularly interested in, so I simply began skipping ahead until they made another move. After resting for a few hours, the entire force of King's Hope moved out, creating a massive herd that equaled the combined population of both cities. This centaur army was undoubtedly even bigger than the one that had invaded the halfling forest before, and began moving to save the third city, the rest of their kind. However, it was no longer my host that was at the lead of the herd, but rather the centaur king, along with his dozen knights. Like before, there was little suspense with what came next. Terra's incarnation once again approached the camp resting outside of Sorrow's shield, though this time with several other halflings accompanying her, and explained the coming danger. This time they seemed to listen to
to the lesson from the previous camps, and immediately began moving towards the forest, much to the confusion of those within the city. Once the army arrived at the border of the forest, I could clearly see a line of armed halflings just behind the trees. However, at that point, it was time for the second part of my plan. Having my host convince the Centaur King was the easy part, surprisingly. Getting it all to work, on the other hand, was different. Unlike most of the halflings who stood within the branches, dreadfully awaiting the arrival of an army, one was strangely eager for what was to come. "What's he going to do now?" Tarak wondered to herself, her lips tugged up slightly as she gripped her spear. She had been given instructions for what to do from her main self, but had no idea what was to come now. Either her main self just didn't want to tell her, or didn't want to use her abilities to spoil the surprise. However, soon a single figure could be seen walking into the forest. To Tarak's surprise, as well as the surprise of many halflings, it was the figure of a pink Charoon, one Tarak undoubtedly recognized as Dale, the host with the most, so to speak. In his hands he tightly gripped a single spear, which had a scroll of leather bound tightly around its shaft. Seeing the scroll, Tarak let out a noise of exclamation, having figured out what the plan was. Her smile widened, even more so when the figure pulled his arm back and threw the spear into the forest, letting the tip dig into the ground at the base of a tree. Afterwards, Dale immediately turned and retreated back to the plains. Several sets of eyes were watching the spear, as if waiting for it to burst into flames. Only one figure leapt down from the branch she was on, steadily approaching the spear and taking the scroll off of it. Several people called out in alarm as Tarak read over the contents. Although no other halfling could understand the physical words, the message would engrave itself into their minds as they read. "Your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to read this writing in order to create an understanding of this language. After reading, please take the time to study these words, and send a reply with a promise scroll. The reward for completing this mission, ultimately, is the shared knowledge of both Charoon and Nightkiller languages." Tarak almost let out a laugh as she read the words contained within the scroll, her body shaking once again. Another figure landed near her, the elder that had met her outside of King's Hope, although he had lost an arm in the escape. He stared at her with concern, as if worrying that the contents of the scroll were some kind of attack. "What is it, Tarak?" he asked. As far as the halflings were concerned, the centaurs had shown no understanding of language as they knew it. Of course, Tarak knew that this was just because their concept of language was too primitive, so they weren't able to recognize a language that wasn't their own as anything other than the jabberings of a beast. Instead of answering, she passed the scroll to the elder, who held it up with his one remaining hand to read it. As he saw the unfamiliar characters, confusion entered his gaze, soon replaced by shock, as the scroll translated itself within his mind. What power is this?" he asked, unable to understand what was happening. Tarak simply laughed, almost sounding broken inside. "Have you never seen the request scrolls of children? Even if they can't read and write, we can still understand what it says. I think this is the same." It took the elder a while to process that information. Only after that did he seem to understand something. His gaze looked out at the Charoon beyond the trees as he clutched the scroll in his hand. "I'll need to take this to the others," he said, as he walked off, deeper into the trees. I shook my head slightly, ignoring the laughs that were coming from behind me. "Really? You used the quest system as a universal translator?" "Not bad, Dale," Tara spoke, almost in tears from laughing. With how awake she was, I imagined that her ninja incarnation must be either asleep or comatose right now. "It seemed appropriate," I said, shrugging my shoulders. Since I included the translation function for people that couldn't read, I figured it might help teach people languages. No, it's good," she confessed, sitting up to look at me with a smile. "I hadn't considered that approach, though this will still not get rid of the hatred between the two races, only make them able to understand each other." I nodded my head slightly.
I know. Right now, I just need to make my host seem as an icon for the two races. Let him become important for a while before I move to the next step. As I said that, I began to fast-forward the world again, this time much faster than I had done previously. The world became a blur of motion as quest scrolls were granted.